All right. Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage Regional Originals brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Evren Ochkin. He's a director, an adapter, a producer, an arts administrator. He was just announced as the interim associate artistic director at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He is a founder of Maya Directors, a consulting group of artists and organizations engaged with Middle Eastern stories and beyond. From 2015 to 2018, he served as the director of new plays and marketing at Golden Thread Productions, the first American theater company devoted to the Middle East, where he is now a resident artist. As an artist, he is under commission with Lila Buck to create an adaptation of 1001 Nights for Cal Shakes, and he has directed new plays all over the country, including at New York Theater Workshop, Jiva Theater Center, Berkeley Rep, South Coast Rep, The Lark, Kennedy Center, Interact in Philadelphia, Cleveland Public, Theater Squared, Magic Theater, Crowded Fire, Golden Thread, Theater First, and the Playwrights Foundation. He has worked with many of the brightest playwriting voices in the country, including Melis Auker, Kevin Artigue, Guillermo Calderon, Christopher Chen, Francis Yachu Kauhig, Gabriel Jason Dean, Yusuf El Gundi, Lauren Gunderson, Prince Gomovias, David Jacoby, MJ Kaufman, Hannah Khalil, Jonas Hassan Kamari, Michael Liu, Mona Mansour, Rahina Liu Mirza, Baruch Porras Hernandez, Betty Shamia, Caridad Svich, Jordan Tannehill, and Lauren Yee, amongst many others. He was a 2015 National Directing Fellow with O'Neill NNPN Kennedy Center and SDCF, and the 2013 Titan Award winner from Theater Bay Area, and selected as an Emerging Theater Leader by TCG for their 2012 Leadership Bootcamp. He is currently in the middle of a workshop of Jisun Choi's The Seekers at Bay Area Playwrights Festival. And Evren, you're making your transition from being my neighbor here in SF to living in Ashland, Oregon, in your new position at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. We're sitting here on a cool, sunny Saturday afternoon in SF in late July while the rest of the country is enduring a massive heat wave. So it's great to grab this moment before you head up to Ashland. Thanks so much for sitting down with us today.
It's great to be here.
The first question I always like to ask all our guests is, where did you grow up and how did you find the theater, or how did the theater find you?
I was born and raised in Turkey, in this town called İzmit, which is about an hour east of Istanbul. And I say it's sort of like the Trenton of Turkey. It's gray, industrial. It's a real city, but it's right next to Istanbul, which is sort of like New York, with, you know, the art center or whatever. And it was a really interesting thing because my whole family are scientists, and my teachers of math and physics, accountants, and I also studied actually computer science in college, but my whole family always does arts on the side. So arts was something that we were really encouraged to take part in. I was a very hammy little kid, talked a lot, still do. So theater and acting was something that just came very naturally. I took part in all of the school plays that I could, and did a little bit of sort of kid acting and professional productions kind of thing in state theaters. And I really found theater, I think, because my parents went so much. I mean, the state theater system in Turkey at that time was amazing, so the tickets were really cheap. So I remember like going to Blood Wedding when I was 8, this like stunning production of Blood Wedding in... at the Istanbul State Theater with my mom. And it was just, so when you're sort of, I find, exposed to that kind of work that early, it sort of leaves a mark. And for me, that meant that I was just obsessed with theater. So I was studying math and science and doing theater on the side, like almost full time, all through middle school, all through high school, and all through college. And it wasn't until really right after college that I even considered that this thing that I loved doing and I was quite good at could become the thing I do.
Yeah.
And not just something I do on the side. And that was really, really amazing. I mean, that switch sort of was a really interesting moment in my life. And I really think I didn't even feel comfortable till I was 28, maybe even 30, to call myself an artist first.
Yes.
I also direct. Was the introduction. And I remember, like, when that sort of, I had to make a decision internally to do that. And I think, yeah, I mean, it was just such a funny thing for me of, I think the being in the Bay Area right after college was a big part of that, that I was able to sort of come to my own realization that this is who I was and this is what I wanted to do, because there are so many smaller theaters in the Bay Area where you can sort of put it together and work, like really, really actually work, not just, you know, assistant direct at a big theater. That was really where the theater being something that I absolutely loved and was good at became the career.
What was it that like opened that door for you, or allowed you to turn that corner to kind of stepping into the kind of fullness of I'm Everin and I direct first?
Yeah. It's so interesting. I think right after college, you know, I graduated from Princeton with a computer science degree in engineering and a minor in directing. I was doing full-time directing and working two jobs because immigrant on full scholarship. I was exhausted. Like when I graduated from college, I don't think I've ever been that tired in my whole life. And it had got to a place where I had to take a break. I decided that for a year or two, I would not direct to see if I missed it, to be honest, because I had basically just done theater my whole life and I couldn't figure out if it was because I loved it or it was just what I was doing. And I was lucky enough to get the communications and graphic design internship at Trinity Rep. So I was still theater adjacent. So I was sort of flirting with the administrative
You're in the
side of things.
building.
Yeah, and Paula Vogel was there, which was super exciting. And I did not direct myself, although I got to see a lot of theater. I got to weasel my way into Paula and Oscar Eustace's workshops for The Long Christmas Ride Home. And so I was in the room, but I wasn't directing. And I really missed it. And that was the sort of aha moment for me. How something really core was missing. And then it was a process of, okay, so given that I don't have any sort of safety net financially, and I'm, you know, like the kind of immigrant that, you know, has to send money back home and all those things, like what does wanting to have a career as an artist look like in this country? And that took a, you know, I don't know, 15 years really. It feels like I just figured it out this year. And that was a really, and so that was a process. And some of it was very intentional, and some of it was, you know, how do I pay my bills and make it work kind of thing. In terms of the specific moment where I actually made that switch, it was Todd London hosted this amazing, I'm trying to remember the name of the program, Third
The Third
Eye.
Bohemia.
Third Bohemia, there you go. That's what it's called. Where they invited not just artists, but like a cross section of really cool folks that had something to do with theater. And really, it was like a 2-day immersive program. And it was actually Eugenie Chen, who's this incredible artist, that sort of gave me that permission, I would say. I was really looking for it, I think, because there were all these other folks who had either grown in artistic families, they were American, so there's sort of a, I don't know, in the West, in the US, there's this sort of sexiness to being a poor starving artist, which like when you're an immigrant, that like holds zero
Sexiness,
excitement. So I was sort of focusing more on this is what makes me money. And I was just watching these folks who were even younger than me or my age really own the artist title in that room and just be really sort of grounded in that. And I remember saying, I was like, huh, I've never called myself an artist first. And Eugenie literally was like, what is wrong with you? In her amazing, generous, supportive way. And she actually gave me this really amazing little paper gift that was all about like overcoming that fear that I still
Oh my
have.
God.
And that goes with me wherever I travel. So like if I'm directing, that little thing is coming with me. And that was the moment I was like, oh, I'm gonna start telling people I'm an artist first. And it was really interesting what a difference that made, because words have power. So in terms of me realizing that every decision I was making, that I was given an option to choose, meant is this helping my art making?
Right.
Even if it has nothing to do with art making.
Right.
Even if it's about a day job, even if it's about a relationship, even if it's about a friendship. Like, this is the thing that is really, the most important thing to me is that I continue to improve as an artist and build a career.
Yes.
And that just like clarified so many decisions in my life. And also, turns out when you introduce yourself to people as an artist or a director first, that's what they remember,
yep.
Which is very helpful in this business.
Yeah, it's really important. So I want to kind of jump ahead because there's so much I want to talk to you about,
yeah.
And you and I can talk all day, as we know.
Truth.
So I really want to make sure we talk about your work at Golden Thread, mm-hmm. and the founding of Maya Directors, which is like a consultancy group.
Yes.
Which is fascinating to me. What are the challenges in telling stories about the Middle East in America today, and how are you facing them with these two different institutions that you're involved with?
Yeah, I mean, I moved to the Bay Area for an ex, so it was a completely personally driven move. And I have the career I have because I was here, and Golden Thread is here, and Taranji Ghazarian, who's the founding artistic director, is here. That's where I grew up. And I actually avoided Golden Thread or meeting with Taranj for 4 years. And it's very signature Taranj. She says she doesn't remember this conversation, but she like had multiple people contact me to convince me to meet with her because, you know, I was this like Turkish director working, and there aren't a whole, at that time, especially there weren't a whole lot of us, especially in the Bay Area. So she's like, people keep telling me about you. We need to meet. So I finally met with her, and I remember like, this is so young male. I was like, well, just so you know, I don't care about Middle Eastern theater. I only care about good theater. Like, that's like one of the first things I said to her. And she goes, well, at least we agree on one thing. And I was like, huh, that is not like, so that's, I was immediately sort of intrigued. And the thing that, and at that time I didn't identify as Middle Eastern really in the US. I certainly did not identify as Muslim. I was still very much in my assimilation immigrant mode. Like, I want to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I grew up here. I want to pass. Like, I can do any work. And I was so worried that those titles, if I took them on, if I put myself in that box, that I would really be boxed in.
Yeah.
In the kind of work I would do. And the thing that Golden Thread gave me is, because it's founded by this incredible woman,
yeah.
who is, you know, like, an immigrant, Iranian, Armenian mix, Christian, Muslim mix, queer, like the slashes are so many,
yes.
like me,
yes.
that the way identity is viewed at that organization is so incredibly inclusive and open, and you can find your own way to tell your own story in it. And this is like what everyone is trying to do now. And Taranj has been doing this for 20 years,
yeah.
right? 22 years. So in that way, it gave me this amazing playground and this supportive family who just said, yes, you are. Whatever you say you are. And let's have you explore that. So I really sort of came into my own way of making sense of what my heritage meant to me at Golden Thread through work. And that's the other thing is, you know, I got so many opportunities there, some of them before I was ready for them, which is the biggest gift you can give to a young emerging artist, and really sort of got to form my own understanding of who I was and how who I was could manifest itself in the room as,
yeah.
you know, a director.
Yeah.
And that is really hard for folks because especially for an identity like Middle Eastern or Muslim, Manasa, you know, Middle Eastern, North African, South Asian, where the narratives have been so co-opted by the mainstream, and these, like, we are actually literally under attack by our government.
Yeah.
And so your art making can be so reactive. So every decision you're making as an art maker is either, do you decide to sell out and tell the people what they want to hear so that you can get the job? Or is everything you're making against what everyone is saying,
yep.
both of which are completely dehumanizing and actually incredibly not inspiring as artists.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a way in which you want to look inside of you and see what the truth you want to put out into the world is. And that's what happened at Golden Thread. And through that, I really found myself alongside Taranj playing different leadership roles within the community because of the Middle East America commissioning project. There were these convenings, and I sort of found myself in those rooms being able to meet other artists who had some shared experience with me and really start building that network, which we're still doing many, many years later, and just get an understanding of how this umbrella that we're all deciding to like stand under actually can work for us. And in what ways are we the same, and in what ways are we different? And that was like the biggest gift of my career. Like that ability to find my own self within this identity, get my spine ready so that when I was ready to step out of that identity or go into a mainstream predominantly white institution and actually advocate for a play I believe in or advocate for myself as an artist, I know who I am in a different way than I could have if I did not have Golden Thread in my life. And Maya was a Maya Directors, which is sort of my current venture
with,
you know, Peron Yousafzadeh, Megan Sandberg Zakian, and Karim Fahmy, three other directors of Manasa descent, really came out of that. It was I realized that along with the community-based work, community-building work I was doing at Golden Thread, and the amazing kind of flexibility and experimentation that's available to you when you're working in this more independent, smaller budget way, I realized I was sort of hungry to take what I learned and who I was and see if I could get that done on a larger canvas.
Right.
So it was... as I started full-time at Golden Thread, which I think was 2015, I was also starting the process of figuring out how I could become more of a freelance director.
So explain what it is, because I think it's kind of Maya, a new thing. Yeah, like, how does it work?
So, it was so interesting. We had no idea what it was for a long time. So, in the four of us met 2017, I hope I'm not lying, 2016 or 2017, at the Middle East America convening at the LARC, that the LARC, Silk Road Rising, which is an amazing company out of Chicago, and Golden Thread in San Francisco hosted. And there were, I don't know, 150 people, which was incredible.
That's great.
To know. Like, anytime I feel alone, I think of that room now.
Yes.
And I knew Karim. And Karim knew, and I knew of Megan because we were both really interested in Jonas Hassan Kamiri's work. And Karim and Peron had worked at a company together. So we found ourselves at the same table over lunch. And within 10 minutes, I was like, oh, you all are doing what I want to do. Your mission is to get in there and change it. Not to do your own thing separate.
Right.
But to like get in there, make some compromises, but also fight the fight.
And by there, you mean like mainstream institution.
Yeah, okay. Larger mainstream institution. And, you know, like Peron was a little bit further ahead than me in my career. So was Megan. Karim and I were sort of in the same world, I think. And it was this really interesting experience of having other folks around me who were who had the exact same experience and also the exact same ambitions as me. And that was incredibly helpful at that moment.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy when you're have any sort of a marginalized identity and you're going into these institutions agreeing to represent that identity, it's really challenging.
Yeah.
And it was just an amazing brain trust. And within like that half hour, we're like, we need to get on a call.
Yeah.
We had no idea what that meant. I was thinking that it would be like this amazing sort of group of artists that can, like,
yes,
you know what I mean, like that was really the extent of what I thought it was gonna be. But and we did that, I think, for about 6 months. We and you know, four very busy directors agreeing to
check
a phone call once a month is actually quite a commitment.
Yeah.
And within like the first few calls, I was like, wow, these people really share my values. And that's the thing that I love about directors, like we are kept so separate.
Yes.
And usually, I mean, like any, you know, profession, but most directors, if I can actually sit down with them and have a conversation, it's that we have a lot to talk about and we can be such support for each other. And because the four of us were such mission-driven folks, it wasn't just an individualistic or a selfish idea of I want to make it. It was like, I want to make it and I want to bring a bunch of people with me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that was really the driving force for all of us. The conversation very quickly turned to, okay, so what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Golden Thread is doing this, Silk Road is doing this, Middle East America is doing this, Noor Theater in New York is doing this. What is the thing that we can do to help push this idea of advocating for Manasa stories in mainstream theater, and then also making sure that when they are done well.
Yeah.
And the artists who are welcomed to those spaces are served
yeah.
the way they should be by those institutions. And the consulting idea actually came from Larissa Fast Horse. Larissa and Ty have Indigenous Direction, which does a very similar thing for Native American voices as a consulting firm.
Yes.
And we got her on the phone just to ask, like, what is that? And within 10 minutes of that conversation, I think we were like, oh yeah, we're going to found a, like, that's what we can do.
And so theaters call this consultancy mm-hmm. or email the main email address of
yeah.
them when they have questions about how to do,
yeah, I mean,
how to tell stories.
You know, we are a for-profit organization. That was really important to us. So they pay us to help them.
Yes.
And that was a very specific decision because what we found is we were all doing like two jobs, one job for our own careers and then the other job to advocacy. Provide advocacy yeah. and consulting, you know, casting and,
mm-hmm.
you know, cultural consultancy for free because yeah. everybody assumed that that work wasn't work when it is actually really valuable work.
Yeah.
And the thing that's been really interesting is that the moment we put some value on that work, and of course we have the ability, the resumes and the experience to be able to back it up too.
Yeah, yeah.
But the conversations you have with people is different.
What
all of a
changed?
Sudden, they take it seriously.
Uh-huh.
It's not just a favor on the side that they're asking. It's like,
right.
if they pay you, they will listen to you in a different way.
Interesting.
And that was like the biggest thing. And what's been so amazing for me is we've gotten to work with much larger institutions like Actors Theatre of Louisville or Cal Shakes. But also we've been able to do work that actually feels very mission-driven because basically the people who are self-selecting or the people who are saying yes to our advocacy work are people who are buying into the value of this work.
Yes.
That in this day and age, we must have Manasa stories as part of the American canon. Like, your theater must produce this work because, as I said, these communities are under attack. And
yes.
if it's about reflecting the world we live in, this is not an if, this is a when.
Yes.
The question. And if you don't have any expertise in doing that, you have to find a partner.
Yeah.
And we are sort of making ourselves available as a partner. And I feel like we've been able to do the kind of advocacy work for through Maya directors that I wasn't able to do before.
Right.
I mean, you know, we worked with Big Bridge Consortium, which is this consortium of Christian colleges, theater programs that wanted to commission a Muslim playwright. And Rohina Malik got it. And now she's going to develop a play from a Muslim perspective and about Muslim identity that most of these 15 Christian colleges are going to do.
Yes.
And those audiences and those students are going to engage with an actual Muslim human being.
That's fantastic.
In an artistic process.
Yes.
Like, that happened because we just literally named ourselves and put ourselves out there. And I don't want to make it seem like, you know, there are plenty of people who say they want to do it. And then when it comes to doing it,
yes.
it doesn't work. But I think we are just part of a movement. That's how I think about it. Like, we are just standing a little behind and next to the folks who've been doing this work like Tarrant forever
yes.
and providing a different kind of institution, a different kind of resource.
Yeah.
To help them do the thing they want to do.
Totally. You've done so much work for the field in terms of equity, diversity, and inclusion, activism, and guiding us towards a broader and richer vision of what our theater could be. You've created Maya, you know, you were involved with Rebecca Novick creating mm-hmm. a kind of open source tool to look at who was getting these artistic leadership positions in this massive turnover that's happening. Can you talk about like what drives that activism and maybe what is your sense of where the field is today and where is it going? Like, can you give us a little bit of a report card?
You know, what's interesting is, and I don't want to sound naive, but like, I don't think of it as activism.
Okay.
It's just, for me, who I am and how I want to live my life and the kind of work I want to see done. And I understand why that feels like activism to folks, because it is not what has been happening. But to me, I'm just sort of a very practical human being. So a lot of my work comes from what is not being done, or how can we do this better, and what can I do in this small way to make it better. The American Theater Leadership Database, really my involvement from about it, like with it, came from that impulse. And I had no idea that it was going to become this thing that now, you know, New York Times has used it and American Theater Magazine reported on it. You know, that's, I signed up for it because I wanted to get some jobs. I wanted to know if there were jobs for me to apply to, and I couldn't because these job job listings are hidden.
Yes.
Which is the stupidest thing if you actually are saying that you want to diversify the pool of people who apply. And I'm a person who knows people, so I could find them, but it was hard.
Yeah.
And when Rebecca asked for help to like organize this, that was my driving thing. I was like, I want a place where for anybody who wants to apply, we can have a list of jobs that are open.
We can just see it.
And then because I'm an engineer and very data-based, sort of it started from there, and then it just sort of grew, and we sort of made the artistic director tracking more robust, and then we realized that people were reading the data wrong, so I had to do like the analysis, but that happened over 3 years.
Yeah.
And then at the end of 3 years, all of a sudden it was a real thing.
Yeah.
And we looked at it, and we both Rebecca and I were like, wow, we actually did in this really incremental way a thing that means something and can be used by others.
Yeah.
So it's a resource not for us only, but like it ends up
for
being
the field.
And I think,
and where, sorry, where is that so that our listeners can just
if you just Google American Theater Leadership Database, it'll come up.
Awesome.
And there's an amazing analysis and article that Deep Tram put together of the database data that for those folks who are not very data-driven, it really parses the data in all of its nuance.
Yeah.
That was really exciting to work with American Theater Magazine on that. And I think for me, the work is always, like, I'm the son of two teachers, you know? So I've been raised to believe I must be in service of others.
Yeah.
That's just a core value. And in this atmosphere and in our current American moment, that others ended up being more folks like me, whether you define that as POC folk, people of color, women, non-gender binary folks, queer folks, whatever it is. And I find that I do my best work as an artistic leader, but also as a director, when the decisions I'm making, the thing I'm looking at, in my mind, is larger than I am.
Yeah.
Right? It actually, that sense of service, that sense of largesse of whatever I'm doing, makes me fill it, like fill the position up in a way. So I have to be better than myself to be able to do it. And that's what I found is how I drive myself.
Yeah.
And it's at this point such a second nature thing. I don't even have to sort of think about it in the same terms. But it's very core to who I am.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like my senior thesis was Medea at Princeton. And I was the other day, as one does, like I'm in this big transition moment. So I was like looking back at things, trying to figure out how the heck I got this incredible opportunity. Like, how did we get here?
Yeah.
You know, and I found all these photos of this senior thesis production that I had set in like Ottoman Empire, the crumbling years of the Ottoman Empire. And the lead was Korean American. The nurse was Chinese American. Jason was Jewish American. We had a black we had a black crayon, we had an Iranian American Aegeus, and like at that time the Princeton Theater Department did not look like that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, this was before I knew the words equity, diversity, inclusion. I was just making work that reflected how I saw it.
Yes.
How I saw the world. And I had to like go, Sharif, who's an incredible poet, I had to like convince him to act. And he was in the poetry department. I found musicians to come in and do things that like never worked in theater. So I was doing this work.
Yeah.
Not because it was the right thing to do, because it's who I am. So in a way, this work is, I think, most powerful when it can be guided by your internal needs rather than some sort of a political action. You know what I mean? I'm so arts-driven.
Yes.
So, and I find that people say yes more when that happens.
For sure. Yeah. So how what is your vision of like how the theater's doing right now? I mean, what has American theater done kind of much better at in the last few years because of this push? And what do we still need to turn our attention to now that is not happening?
I mean, the thing that's really interesting about that question, right, is as liberals, as progressives, as activists, I'm doing air quotes right now, podcast listeners, we must be driven by a sense of never good enough.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We must always look at the person that's left behind. We must always look at the stories that we're leaving on the table and try to find more ways to serve those folks and welcome them into our spaces. Having said that, sometimes that means we don't get to celebrate enough. And I think we really have to take a moment right now to celebrate where the American theater is, because it's so much better in so many different ways. So many amazing folks, whether it be Nataki at OSF, Hana Sharif at St. Louis Rep, you know, we have gotten these incredible leaders that don't look like the leaders of the last 60 years in these spaces. Now the question becomes, okay, we've done that. You know,
yeah.
All these folks who are marginalized are getting more jobs. Fantastic. So now the question, which is where Maya comes in a way, Maya Directors comes in, how do we help them succeed?
Yeah.
How do we change our systems? How do we create resources so that these folks that are now in the building can be the best they can be?
Yeah.
How do we change our systems so that whatever systemic issues we're facing that are making it so these folks can't succeed are no more.
Yeah.
And that is a much harder conversation. We've spent so much time feeling like hiring people was the hardest thing.
Yes.
When it was actually literally just hire them was the solution to that.
Yes.
You know? Now we're in that next space. And I think this is where it's going to get a little difficult. So I'm sort of ready for great success. And there's such great opportunity. But also, there will be a tumultuous time where these leaders, these artists are, by who they are, challenging and questioning a lot of givens about our field, right? And we as a field need to welcome those questions and figure out the best way that we can help solve those issues. And that's going to be difficult. So we're like at an amazing place, and I feel so energized by this moment of opportunity, but I'm also very aware that this is the moment where like we can't actually say, great, all these people got hired, done,
right?
You know, we move on. It's like now is the time where the work starts.
Is that something that you are specifically anticipating in your new role at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in terms of meetings? Like they've, you know, Oregon Shakespeare Festival is a leader for hiring.
I know.
But like, how do you anticipate like starting to face these challenges at a particular institution?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting thing. It's so early in my tenure.
Yeah.
The thing I would say is the reason why I was so excited by OSF, other than, you know, Nataki Garrett being the new artistic director, who's a person that's so important in my life and career and someone that I've really look up to and want to support and learn from. Is, you know, OSF is the vanguard institution in the conversations around equity, diversity, and inclusion. And they're so far ahead of the field in a lot of ways. And, but that also means that they are, there is no example we can look to solve these issues.
The problem of being a pioneer is you're the first.
Exactly. And we have to, so in a way, really changing my mindset to look at any challenging issues or conversations as an opportunity to actually enact my values is the biggest thing for me right now.
Yeah.
You know, entering those rooms and when something is going wrong in a way that doesn't feel just, when something is going wrong that is very emotional for folks because it's actually digging up centuries of trauma, you know, as a lot of people of color, especially Black folks, carry in this country. How do we make space for that?
Yeah.
And how do we continue to move the organization forward towards a better place while making room for all of these conversations is the work.
Yeah.
I was just talking to another sort of person who's in a similar position with me at another organization, and they were saying, it took me a couple of years to realize that this wasn't my side job, this EDI conversation, yes. It was actually the job.
The job.
And I really feel that. And the thing about it is, we in the American theater, and thankfully this is not really what OSF has done, but I've been in a lot of institutions where they look at EDI work as charity,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that they do their good work,
yep.
and then they must do charity work to help those poor folks. We're past that at
not
this
helpful.
Moment. Not helpful. And also, you know, a Black director, choose the best ones. Like, they are some of the best artists working in the American theater. People of color, women, non-gender binary folks, we are all making some of the best theater. So for me, the question is, are you going to be able to change yourself so that you can do the best work?
Yeah.
So the moment you change that paradigm, and as I said, thankfully, I don't have to fight that at OSF.
Right.
That's the given. At OSF, really, it's all about how do we set people up for success,
yep.
and how this really big institution that has so much machinery,
yeah.
to be able to do that reproduction can become flexible or not to support these things, support these people, and the kind of questions they need to bring to the table. And that's, I mean, talk to me in a year.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
Like right now, it's pretty exciting, to be honest, to be in those rooms, to
yes.
see that next layer of challenging conversation happen in front of you, and to be standing next to someone like Nataki, who is a badass and incredibly
yeah.
smart, really help guide those conversations towards a more constructive space.
Yes.
And, you know, that feels like a gift right now. But again, you know, in a year, I might be so exhausted
right.
that I will have a different opinion.
I love the full circle of this, that like Nataki was our final episode of season one, and you're our final episode of,
look at that.
Of season two. We only have about 15 minutes left,
yeah.
and there's so many other things that I want to cover. Among the many things that I admire about you is that you can walk into these traditionally white institutions as a freelance director with their workplace culture as it is, and yet as a queer person of color, you stride confidently in there and identify, I hear you, you know, like I hear you in meetings identifying the structural inequities with so much clarity and strength. And I just feel like this is a great opportunity to ask you know, if you have any advice for other freelance directors that are mm-hmm. walking into those institutions, and how to carry with them their point of view and their values without compromise, knowing that they are strengthening those institutions by calling them out.
That's such a good question. I mean, I want to start by identifying sort of some of the privileges I have walking into those spaces.
Yes.
You know, I
yes.
am a queer person of color, but I'm fairly white passing. I am a tall, white passing man with graying hair, which so people look to me like I'm the expert of everything now. That like a younger Black woman freelance director will not have the same sort of space given right away.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I can be very stealthy
yeah, yeah.
in being able to call people out without ruffling certain feathers. Having said that, I feel like over the years figured out certain things. And those things for me, and this is what works for me, is I tend to call out what's happening rather than call out people.
Yeah.
For me to call out a person, I really need to know internally that they're coming from a bad place. You know?
Yeah.
Because most folks, is this true? Some folks, in the American theater make horrible decisions thinking they're doing something good. And those are the people that I try to help. So I'm really always, any company I'm entering to, I try to figure out who the allies are, even if they're problematic in different ways, and try to set up a situation where they help me and this production and the communities that I'm trying to. And most of the time with those folks, they want to do the right thing. They just don't know any better. And that also means, though, is I try not to spend too much time on the folks who are working against me.
Yeah.
Right? So it's really about that choice process. And unfortunately, it's so hard to know what those red flags are until you've made some bad choices and ended yourself up in bad rooms where you're like, oh, I don't want to be here.
Oh, no.
But having said that, you know, so I do try to, I really kind of announce what's happening. That's like my recent thing where I'm like, what I'm seeing happen in this room is this.
Yeah.
And if you can say that clearly, I find, I mean, there's usually a panic emotion moment, but people want to fix it.
Yeah.
And it sort of allows people to speak to that issue without getting too defensive.
Because you're talking about facts.
Yeah. You know, and I also find that, I mean, Maya Directors is a great example of this. I am done at this point doing free labor for folks around these works. This work is work and you need it.
Yeah.
So you should be paying me or someone else who's qualified to help you. You know, like, in, I will do some of it if I'm a director, like you're paying me as a director, so I'll do some of it.
Yeah.
But I actually think you should hire someone else to do this work for you.
Yeah.
Because I have enough to do. You know, so I'm sort of try to be very clear around what I'm willing to do and when. And that, I think, clarity actually helps folks. So I think that those are my sort of two thoughts. Is,
that's great.
You know, and it's just the thing I will say, and this is kind of a moment of transition, right? Find the people who have your back, you know, that might have nothing to do with that situation. It's been really heartening and amazing to have so many folks, as I got this appointment, come out of the woodwork from my past, or people who I've respected for years that I haven't met yet, come out and say, what do you need?
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Text me, call me. And that is actually what you have to do for yourself. And that's what I mean. Like, if you're in a director who's facing an issue, I assure you, tens, hundreds of other directors have had the exact same issue.
Yeah.
How do you create those networks for yourself? Because it is so easy in our business to feel alone.
Yeah.
Like, you're the only person who has ever dealt with this racism.
Right.
In these spaces. When that's not true. People have been dealing with this for 60 years, whenever, you know, since the regional theater movement was started. So how do you find those folks for you, either to give you advice and, like, literally help you, or just listen to you vent? Because sometimes you just have to get that emotion out of your system so you can go back in there and fight the fight the next day.
Right. You and I have gotten together over the years to have long, deep yes. chats about how hard it is out there for directors who are coming up. And I remember us talking about the National Directing Fellowship that both you and I participated in, and how that was like one of so few programs out there True. To support the path of emerging directors, and even how that program needed to recalibrate at a certain point to realize like how much need was out there, and how the need was no longer like assistant directing a workshop, but actually a much more advanced stage of directors were still waiting to get their foot in the door for that like first big production. So your determination, talent, and nimbleness have moved you now into a powerful position at one of the country's biggest institutions. Where should tomorrow's Everin look to move their careers forward? Like the Everin that you were 5 years ago as you applied for that National Directing Fellowship, like where are the opportunities that you would point that person toward?
The National Directing Fellowship was like completely career changing for me. So that is certainly an amazing opportunity to find a cohort of folks who can support you. Again, I keep coming back to this. Like, there is mentorship that's really helpful. And I can't say enough about the folks I've named, Nataki and Eric Ting and Chayu and Toranjie Gyazarian, who have provided me with that kind of mentorship. But there is an incredible amount of power for folks who are your contemporaries. And I feel like I've found some amazing folks through that program, both from my cohort and, like you, folks who were in
In other
other
cohorts, yeah.
cohorts. It really sort of formed a specific kind of family for me that was helpful. And the hardest thing with directing career is I don't know how one makes it, because the way I made it, I feel like, was so non-traditional. Because of not having a financial safety net, my career path was always about how do I continue to live and get the skills I need to get when I cannot say yes to an assistant directorship at ACT,
Yeah.
when I cannot just go to Minneapolis
Yeah.
and travel by myself and meet artistic
All
directors.
those
Like, what?
unpaid
Yeah,
things.
that
Yeah.
people have to do. And I can't intern. Like, the reason why I did the Trinity Rep internship was because it paid and
Yeah.
gave you housing. And there were like two of those in the whole country. So if I didn't get that one, it wasn't like other internships were free. All
Right.
the internships in the Bay Area were, they didn't pay. In the Bay Area, where there was so, it's so expensive to live here.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, I think, for emerging directors, like, find your day job. I mean, like, I know this sounds crazy, but and find a day job that helps you either be so flexible that you can do all this work, or, like me, is inside a theater and gives you management skills and administrative skills that are applicable to this
Yes.
career. I mean, the reason why I would like to, like, one of the reasons why Nataki sort of picked me for this position, and because I was able to be up for some other artistic directorship kind of
Yes.
opportunities, is because I have been a high-level marketing person at much larger
Yeah.
institutions. It's not just because of my artistic career.
Right.
It's my fundraising experience. It's my marketing experience. It's the fact that I have managed large budgets
Yeah.
and know how that works. And
You were a marketing person for Magic
Magic Theater,
Theater, for American
ACT,
Conservatory
and
Theater,
KQED, which is a huge
KQED.
NPR PBS affiliate in San Francisco. And I cannot say enough about what that job at KQED did for me. Not just in my directing, too, because the management training, literal training I got at KQED, was life-changing. It's completely changed the way I interact and collaborate with folks. And those skills are real skills that, if you are interested in artistic administration, is incredibly important. And some of that decision making was very specific, where I was like, I need to be here to get a sense of how this thing is done at an organization like ACT. And some of it was, this is my skill set and I need to make a living. And now, looking back, it was the smartest decision I've made.
Right.
The other thing that's always the biggest challenge for me has been, when do you say yes and jump off the cliff, right? Because
Okay.
that's what that feels like. When you're someone who has to make a living, when you're someone who doesn't have a safety net, there are opportunities that are floated your way.
Yeah.
And when is the moment, like, internally knowing when the moment to quit your day job and say yes
Yeah,
to that
yeah.
opportunity is hard.
Yeah.
And that, I remember, this was many, many years ago, I was asked to assistant director at OSF, two jobs, and I turned it down, which I remember the person who was offering to me on the job on the phone was completely surprised, because I don't think they had ever been turned down before,
Right.
because they pay and they give you housing. But I was looking at my life, and
And you
I
couldn't
could not,
jump.
no, I wasn't ready. If
Yeah.
I jumped for that, I did not see how I was gonna land.
Right.
And
'Cause it's long. Those
it's a
rehearsal periods at OSF are like double at
yeah, and
least.
there was I was and it was two shows, so I was like basically
Oh my
gonna have to
gosh.
quit my job, not have health care.
For like 4 months.
Yeah, and that was not a risk I could take.
Yeah.
I for me, again, like, no one can pay my rent if I don't pay my rent, right? Like, and that's a real thing. And I think sometimes we think about those things like they don't matter, and they really do. They really, really do. And I said no to that. And now, you know, whatever, 10 years later, I get to go into OSF with healthcare for this amazing position. And that's that full circleness of it all is incredibly exciting, like empowering for me to be, to know that now is the time I can jump in a different way.
Yeah.
And I've made some decisions along the way, not just career-wise, but life-wise, to be able to get me 45 years ago to be able to quit my money-making job and actually take an administrative job at Golden Thread, which paid significantly less, but gave me all these other things.
Yes.
And all of those decisions, we have to look at it as a holistic thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm really excited that it's worked out, you know. And, I mean, on the flip side, though, there's luck is such a huge yeah. part of how these things happen. Like, if I did not meet Nataki 7 years ago at the San Diego Theater Communications Group conference
yeah.
in front of the elevators at midnight
right.
when we were both leaving the party and feeling terrible about our lives and ourselves and ended up finding each other and talking for hours
yeah.
about, like, providing support for each other, although we had just met.
Yes.
Like, that was luck.
Right.
Right? But it was luck that put me in the right place and I was able to have the right skill sets to
yes.
say yes and hopefully succeed now that I've been given that opportunity because of that lucky moment.
That's amazing. We only have time for like one more question. Great. So, and I feel we've been naughty and not talking about craft very much. So I just want to turn to craft for a second. It used to be that a play meant a lot of words on a page written by a playwright that actors would perform. And today, I think the way we see and think about plays has expanded. I'm thinking about your production of I Call My Brothers, which is kind of like an extended hip-hop like poem narrative. And We Swim, We Talk, We Go to War. That is also kind of feels like has an experimental structure to it. So I just want to ask you, you know, how do you read new plays differently than you read classics? How do you approach a new play? What do you think new plays are offering us as directors?
It's such an interesting moment right now in the American theater because we are really, new voices have been lifted up in a really significant way in the last 10 years. And what's exciting to me is that playwrights are being encouraged to be bold and ambitious and break some rules and think on large canvases. And what's been really lovely, because those are all things that I am naturally inclined to do, that, you know, think big and think experimentally, think non-linear, which is how classics work, by the way. Like, this is not a new idea, right?
Yes.
Like, Shakespeare plays are pretty darn experimental structurally.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're sort of feels like going back to this moment, I hope, where theater is very theatrical and is ambitious. And I find that as a director, as a producer, as I'm trying to create rooms in which that ambition can flourish, right? In that, I mean, I just started rehearsals with Ji-San Choi on this play, which is a dreamscape of a play. It's perfectly imperfect. You know, it doesn't tie it together, but then it does in an emotional way.
Mm.
And as we are looking to clarify that play, it's so important that we set up a room where we're not removing whatever is special about that play. And I always start by, I want to start every process like this is the best play ever. And I think that's a thing with new plays that's really important to me, is this writer, wherever they may be in their development, is possibly writing the best play ever. So how do we all work so hard to show them what yeah. they've written and lift that up? And I think that creation, craft-wise, I like to think that I straddle both writing and acting, so story and character-driven work, and also design and technical aspects or ambitious visuals, which is much more of sort of a liminal space. And I'm really excited by works and excited by artists, whether it be writers or actors or designers, that straddle those worlds too. So whenever I'm working on an experimental thing, right, like Guillermo Calderon's Kiss, I'm looking for the story and the character. And when I'm working on something really realistic, like Jordan Tannehill's Late Company, I'm looking for the big metaphor,
mm-hmm.
right? And yeah. that's just how my brain works, right? And I think I try to create rooms in which both of those questions can be working at the same time. And that requires, I found, a clarity of intention with each statement you're making, and also an openness for another statement to be made.
Yeah.
Right? So being yeah. able to have clarity at every moment, including when you don't know something and someone else's idea is better.
Right.
Right? Like it's, and that pull and push and give and take is my favorite thing. I mean, that's the thing is, the reason why I went from acting to directing is because it was very clear to me very early on. One, I was paying attention to the wrong things. Like as an actor, you need to look ahead of you. And I was just always interested in everything else.
Everyone just like looked around the room like yeah. everything it's is
like,
beautiful.
I'm like up and staring at the lights rather than, you know, like speaking my lines. But also because I love rehearsal. I love rehearsal. Rehearsal is the one place I feel the most in my body. And most freed and not questioning myself, because that room of creativity is where I am fully engaged with all of myself. And I hate performance. Like once we've said it.
Right. It's like no more discoveries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that sort of sharing with the audience is really exciting, but I'm hungry for that search. I'm hungry for that creative room where we're making decisions on the go. So yeah, directing is, you know,
yeah,
pretty clearly where I was meant to be. But that sort of search and creative pursuit and creating a space in which where those creative pursuits are tied to some difficult questions around identity or politics or real things that are happening in the world, that's where I get excited. And that's the craft for me that I've been working really hard to hone. How do you hold that room? How do you create that room so that everyone in it can do their best work and can do things you didn't know they could do?
Mm.
Right? Like that's the exciting stuff. That's when that happens. It's like magic, you know? And that's what I always say. Like actors are unicorns to me. They're like magical. What they're able to do every day, I couldn't do.
It's astonishing.
It's like even actors who are not as experienced, like the how brave they have to be every day in the room or in the audition, whatever. Like I am fascinated by that. So if I can set up a room in which where everybody gets to do that all the time and I get to watch and give opinions, like that's, how is that my life? Yeah. You know? So that's a, and I try, and I hope this is coming through. Like, I have a real sense of wonder
mm-hmm.
about the theatrical creative process. And even after whatever, if we count from my acting debut at age 4, 35 years of doing it, it's still wondrous. And that's basically really important to me, that as I continue to build this career, that sense of wonder
mm-hmm.
sticks with me. And thus far, it's okay, but that's like the goal.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be like 85 years old and still surprised by an actor in a room, you know?
Wonder seems like a great place to end the conversation. Before we say goodbye, though, if you have any work coming up.
So in the fall is mostly workshops towards things in 2020, because I, you know, as part of taking this job, I had to step out of a lot of directing positions. But the two that I am working on are, I'm doing Heather Raffo's Nine Parts of Desire at Portland Center Stage.
Yes.
As part of Marissa Wolfe's first season, who produced some of my very key early works at Crowded Fire in tiny little spaces. And,
yes.
You know.
So when will that be?
That's going to be in March
okay.
of 2020. And then, as you said at the beginning, I'm working on a commission of an adaptation, although it's more like a new play inspired by 1001 Nights, with Leila Buck, who's this incredible Lebanese-American writer and community builder like me, for Cal Shakes. And that's going to be the summer of 2020. Fantastic. So those are the two sort of projects I'm working on. And it's kind of... it feels really amazing right this moment to sort of have those artistic touch points, to be honest, because I'm like about to run into so much administration.
Yes.
In a way, to have these moments of like, I get to be an artist too, is very helpful.
That's fabulous. Well, I hope people can check out those things at Portland Center Stage and Cal Shakes. And thanks so much for spending a little time with me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.